All right, so get ready because today we're taking a deep dive into, well, deep dives themselves, university endowments to be exact. We're talking serious money here, folks, billions and billions of dollars, and we're going to compare how two absolute titans of the academic world, Oxford and Yale, manage these massive financial resources.
It's a bit like peeking behind the curtain at a magic show, right?
Right.
We see these prestigious institutions, but how does their financial engine really work?
Exactly. And the really cool thing about the source material we're looking at is it takes us right into the heart of Oxford. It's like being a fly on the wall during a fictional meeting at Queen's College, and they're debating whether they should completely change their investment strategy.
And the big catalyst for all this is the famous Yale model of investing, pioneered by David Swensen, which is known for really diving headfirst into alternative investments, things like private equity and hedge funds.
So, not your typical stocks and bonds. I'm already intrigued. So we've got Oxford, this incredibly old institution with centuries of tradition, a history of land ownership, more conservative investments. Up against the Yale model, it sounds like a real clash of financial philosophies.
Absolutely. In one corner, we have this American fellow at Oxford, we'll call him Ed, and he's really championing the Yale model, arguing that it's all about finding those hidden gems, these inefficient markets, where you can potentially get much higher returns.
Okay, so paint a picture for me here. Where are these inefficient markets that we're talking about?
Well, think of it this way. The Yale model does things like private equity, real estate, natural resources, assets that aren't traded on public exchanges every second of the day, which makes them by nature less liquid. And Ed's big argument is that this illiquidity actually works in your favor, that you're essentially rewarded, what they call an illiquidity premium, for being willing to, you know, tie your money up for a longer period of time.
So less of a quick flip, more of a long game.
Exactly. And Ed's argument, he backs it up by pointing to Yale's really impressive returns. They average 7.4% a year over a decade, which beat the pants off traditional stock and bond markets. He also highlights how Yale weathered that 2008 financial crisis, arguably better than many universities, precisely because of this approach.
Okay, starting to see the appeal here. But I'm guessing not everyone at Oxford is buying into this whole Yale model.
You're right, not everyone is convinced. In the other corner, we've got, let's call him Hatter, a skeptical Oxford fellow who's perfectly content with Queen's existing approach, a predominantly passive strategy that's heavily reliant on index trackers and local real estate.
So more of a slow and steady wins the race kind of approach. What does their track record look like?
Well, Hatter's very proud to point out that Queen's has achieved a very respectable 11% average annual return over the past 10 years with their current strategy. His argument is basically, why fix what isn't broken? He's not totally sold on this whole illiquidity premium idea either, suggesting that maybe the high demand for alternative investments might actually be eroding any extra returns that were once there.
Ah, so it's like that old saying, if it sounds too good to be true.
Precisely. And Hatter brings up a very interesting point about that 2008 financial crisis that I'd mentioned earlier. While Yale might have recovered well, a lot of other universities that tried to jump on the alternative investment bandwagon ended up getting burned badly. They had to take on debt, lay off staff, some even considered selling off valuable assets just to stay afloat.
Ouch. Yeah, that doesn't sound good at all. So maybe this Yale model is a bit riskier than it first appears.
That's Hatter's argument, for sure. But it gets even more interesting when he starts poking around the whole issue of potential conflicts of interest within the endowment management industry in general. He really zeroes in on these massive salaries that CIOs, you know, the people managing these huge sums of money, are pulling in.
Okay, so how much are we talking about here? Are CIOs getting paid like rock stars?
You might say that. Hatter points out that many CIOs have pretty close ties to private equity firms, which raises the question, are they truly putting the university's interests first, or are they being swayed by their own potential personal gain?
So are you saying that some of these folks might actually be pushing for riskier strategies just to line their own pockets, even if it's not in the best interest of the university itself?
That's the concern Hatter is raising. And it's not even necessarily about, like, you know, shady backroom deals or outright corruption. It's more about the incentives that are baked into the whole system. If a big chunk of your compensation is tied to how well these alternative investments perform, well, there might be, you know, even if it's subconscious, a bias there to favor those, even if something more conservative would make more sense for the university in the long run.
So not necessarily bad intentions, but maybe a bit of a blind spot.
Exactly. And to his credit, Hatter, he even brings up David Swensen, you know, Yale's legendary CIO, who's generally praised for, you know, his dedication to the university. Even Swensen wasn't exactly underpaid, even though he often said he took a lower salary than he could have gotten on Wall Street. He was still making millions of dollars a year.
Right. Underpaid is a relative term when you're talking about those figures, for sure. It does make you wonder if the allure of a salary like that, even with the best of intentions, could still cloud someone's judgment.
It's a valid point, and Hatter really doesn't let up here. He brings up example after example of endowment managers raking in millions while their funds are actually underperforming. He's really hammering home this point that, you know, a big salary doesn't necessarily mean someone's a financial wizard.
Yeah, like getting a bonus for striking out.
Exactly. So it really raises these crucial questions about accountability, right? Is this current system, with all its emphasis on copying the Yale model, chasing those alternative investment returns, is it really serving these institutions the way it should?
So are there other approaches out there? Is everyone just blindly following the Yale model?
Not necessarily. And this is where it gets really interesting, because remember how Ed kept talking about those inefficient markets that the Yale model targets? Well, Hatter argues that maybe those markets aren't so inefficient anymore.
What does he mean?
Well, think about it. Everyone and their grandmother has heard of the Yale model now, right? So naturally, they all want a piece of the action. But when too much money is chasing after a limited number of opportunities, that's going to drive prices up, which actually ends up eroding those higher returns that everyone's looking for.
So it's kind of like a self-defeating prophecy. The more popular the Yale model becomes, the less effective it might actually be.
Exactly. And this is where Hatter really throws a curveball into the conversation by bringing up the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, or GPSFG for short.
Okay, I've heard whispers about this fund. It's absolutely massive, right? How does it fit into this?
It fits in perfectly, because Hatter uses them as an example of a totally different approach. This fund, we're talking over $1 trillion. That's trillion with a T. They mostly just track global indexes.
Wait, so they're basically saying, forget all the fancy stuff. We're just going to mirror the market.
Essentially. And here's the kicker.
Yeah.
They've actually achieved really good returns with this approach, kept their costs really low.
So are they saying that you don't need all this complexity to be successful, that bigger doesn't have to mean riskier with these huge fees, that maybe there's a simpler way to do things?
That's exactly what Hatter is getting at. And he's not just pulling this example out of thin air. He points out that even Japan's massive pension fund, the GPIF, which is known for being ultra-conservative, even they've started to dip their toes into alternative investments.
It seems like even the giants are starting to rethink their strategies a bit. It makes you wonder if maybe there's a middle ground here, a way to balance the potential rewards of alternative investments with the need for transparency, accountability, and just a healthy dose of skepticism.
And that's where the Canadian model comes into play.
Wait a minute, hold up. Canada has its own investment model now. Tell me more.
Oh, they do. Just as our Oxford debate is heating up, this new voice chimes in, a professor of financial economics from Toronto, let's call her Jen, and she's there to explain how the Canadians do things a little differently. Specifically, this group called CPPIB, which manages the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board.
All right, Jen, lay it on us. What's the Canadian secret sauce?
Well, right off the bat, Jen explains that CPPIB doesn't even really think in terms of those traditional asset classes we've been talking about, like stocks, bonds, real estate, all that.
Really? So how do they divide up the investment pie then?
Instead of these broad categories, they focus on something called underlying risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of just seeing a stock or a bond, they analyze the stuff that actually drives risk and return. Value, growth, momentum, you name it.
So they've gone deeper to understand the DNA of an investment, regardless of what you call it on the surface.
That's a great way to put it. And here's where it gets really interesting. They have this thing called the reference portfolio.
Sounds intriguing. What is it?
It's basically like their baseline, a simple passive portfolio, you know, like 65% stocks, 35% bonds, that kind of thing. And they use that as a benchmark to measure all their other investment decisions against.
So it's like if they want to do something fancier than that basic portfolio, they need a really good reason.
You got it. Jen argues that this reference portfolio keeps them honest. It forces them to be disciplined. Instead of just chasing after the latest hot investment, the people managing money at CPPIB always have to justify why doing something is better than just sticking with their basic portfolio.
I like it. It's like a built-in BS detector for fancy investments. But how does this reference portfolio thing actually work in practice?
Imagine you're a fund manager at CPPIB, and you stumble across this amazing tech stock, you think it's going to be the next Google. Before you can even think about investing, you have to compare that stock to the reference portfolio. You have to be able to prove, with data, that putting money into this tech stock would give a better return, after you account for risk, than just sticking with their boring old mix of stocks and bonds.
Okay, so it adds a layer of accountability, prevents those impulsive decisions just based on hype, but doesn't that limit their flexibility? What if there's some amazing opportunity that comes along that doesn't really fit into their reference portfolio?
That's a great question, and it's something that Hatter brings up too. He argues that CPPIB's reference portfolio, while well-intentioned, might be a little too simplistic, that maybe they're missing out on some potentially great returns by not being a little bit more nuanced, especially when it comes to that whole factor investing idea we touched on earlier.
So they're really committed to this, like, keep it simple philosophy, even if it means they might miss out on some of those big, exciting investments.
That seems to be the Canadian way, at least when it comes to their pensions. But there's another layer to this whole model that we haven't even touched on yet. Direct investing.
Okay, when you say direct investing, what do you mean? Are they, like, buying up all the local businesses in Toronto?
Not quite. Direct investing, in this case, means that CPPIB often invests directly in companies and projects, you know, on their own, instead of going through these big external fund managers.
So they're, like, their own in-house private equity firm. That's a pretty bold move.
It is, and it seems to be working out for them. They've had quite a few successful direct investments. Like, there was that time they invested in Skype back in 2009, put in $300 million, and just 2 years later, boom, sold their stake to Microsoft for almost $1 billion.
Wow, talk about return on investment. But doesn't something like that require a ridiculous amount of expertise? I mean, to sniff out those deals, evaluate them properly, manage them, this isn't your average retirement planning, is it?
You're telling me. And that's actually one of the big advantages that CPPIB has. You know, they've got the resources, they've got these in-house experts who can spot those opportunities, evaluate them, and actually manage those complex deals, something that most smaller institutions could only dream of doing.
So it's like having a whole team of dealmakers on staff just waiting for the right moment to strike.
Exactly. And here's the best part. Because they're doing it all themselves, they're cutting out those massive fees that these external fund managers love to charge, which can really eat into your returns. Plus, they have more control over their investments, which means they can hold on to them for longer periods, potentially benefiting from long-term growth.
Okay, so there's definitely an upside here, but I'm guessing it's not all sunshine and roses. What about the downsides to this direct investing strategy?
Well, like Hatter points out, even if you're not paying those crazy external management fees, building and maintaining a top-notch in-house team of specialists doesn't come cheap. You have to be competitive to attract the best people, right? So that means high salaries, benefits, all the overhead that comes with having a larger, more specialized staff.
Right, so it's a trade-off. You might get higher returns and more control, but you're also taking on the cost of basically creating a whole new internal department.
Exactly. It's all about figuring out that balance. And like most things in finance, there's no single right answer. It all depends on the specific circumstances, the size of the fund, how much risk they're comfortable with, their long-term goals. It's complicated.
This is really making me think. You know, it seems like managing these massive endowments, it's not as simple as just picking the best strategy.
Absolutely. And that's what makes all of this so interesting, you know? It's not just about crunching numbers and trying to squeeze out every last percentage point of return. It's about understanding the big picture, weighing those risks and rewards, and then finding a strategy that truly aligns with the values and circumstances of that specific institution.
It's like, at the end of the day, these are still decisions being made by people, and people are complicated.
Couldn't agree more. And as we've seen for this deep dive into the world of Oxford, Yale, and even Canada, there's no shortage of opinions on how to manage these vast sums of money.
So, for someone who's been listening to all of this, trying to make sense of it all, what's the big takeaway? Where do we even begin to unpack all of this?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Maybe instead of just focusing on maximizing returns no matter what, we should also be asking ourselves, what are these endowments really for? How can we make sure that they're being managed in a way that benefits everyone, not just the institutions themselves, but society as a whole?
Now there's an idea I can really get behind, something to think about for all of us.